AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hi, this is Eddie Beeson. I'm the guy in Grease. I'm the guy in the Polar Express and a lot of much worse movies, a lot of turkeys. I want to say hi. This is me being on my friend DK's show at the Cult Classics podcast.
Hello there, cultists. We have another special treat for you today. Today I'm going to be talking to a legend who has appeared in such movies as Grease, War Games, 1941, Critters 2, and The Polar Express. He's a comedian, actor and writer, and he's graciously taken time out of his schedule to be with us today. It's the incomparable Mr. Eddie Deeson. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, DK.
No problem.
I hear you have a wonderful show. I'm very flattered to be on it. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us today. How are things going
sure.
with you?
Very good. I was at the movies today. I finally saw Deadpool versus Wolverine, and nobody told me, DK, they have a tribute to Grease in it. I was surprised. I was watching the movie, and it's a good movie. It's very funny, but then they played a song from Grease in it. I can't believe nobody told me. I have all these Facebook friends, and I'm sure some must have seen it. I can't believe nobody told me, but that flipped me out, so I love that. That was my favorite part of the movie, but it's a very, very funny movie. Ryan Reynolds is so talented, so funny. The jokes come so fast and furious, some went over my head, but it was a clever and original movie, and that's what you want. It was a very unique, original movie, and I loved it. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, fantastic. So you're having a good day, yeah?
Yes, I'm having a great day.
Oh, great. Well, if it's okay, I'll get right down to the questions, and we'll see.
Yes, sir, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
The first one, how did the whole journey begin for you? How did you break into acting?
Well, okay, I wanted to be a comedian. I wanted to get into show biz very bad. So I grew up in Cumberland, Maryland, LaVale, Maryland, a little suburb in Cumberland, Maryland. It's in Western Maryland. And I literally graduated high school. I left for Hollywood the next day. I was on the plane the next day. That's how bad I wanted to get out of there.
Whoa.
And I got into L.A. I got on an old – well, here's what happened. I started at the Comedy Store. DK, I don't know if you know the Comedy Store.
I do, where, yeah.
Jimmy Walker started there. Robin Williams was there. Dave Kaplan back in the day, Freddie Prinze, he's long gone, but he was a comedian there. A lot of comedians got their start there, so I was there three times. I realized stand-up wasn't for me. I always had a hard time memorizing lines, so I knew I couldn't be a stand-up comic, and I didn't enjoy it that much. Then I got on a show, I don't know if you know this, DK, I was on a show called The Gong Show. Do you know that show?
Oh, I've heard of it. Being over in
Europe,
I've
not
actually
seen it. The Gong Show is like a talent show.
Yeah,
it was a talent show, and if they don't like it, there was a big Chinese gong there, a giant gong, like about 8 feet in circumference, and if they didn't like it, they'd come and gong you, they'd hit a big gong. So I was doing my routine, and I hit the gong, and they gonged me. A singer named Paul Williams gonged me, and I was taken off, but I made like $150, it was a great day, and that was my TV debut. Then about a couple months later, I got a Grease. It took me 2 years, but I lucked out, I got Grease. So Grease was the turning point. I got into this legendary movie. Most people's first movie is a turkey. You usually start out and your first movie is going to be a B movie who's going to put you in a big movie if you're green, you've never done a film. But I was green. It was my first movie. And they put me in, the biggest musical of all time, maybe after The Wizard of Oz, So they put me in Grease and I got into this legendary film. And it's like it's a classic. So I totally lucked out. Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, it was your first big role was Eugene in Grease, and it was such
that
a
was my right. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily. You're too kind. I would say it wasn't necessarily a big role, but I get hit in the face with a pie, and I walk down the stairs, and the T-Birds mess with me, and you'll see me jumping around the dance scene, and then at the end I wave goodbye to John and Olivia when they fly off in the car. When we did DJ, when we did the Polar Express, I was talking to Tom Hanks about it, and we were talking about Grease. And that was his favorite part. That was the part he singled out. He goes, we were talking about Grease. He goes, oh, I love Grease. He goes, I love when John and Olivia fly off and you guys all wave to him. It's like, that whole movie, and that's what he singled out. He liked the part where we waved to him at the end in the car.
How easy or difficult was that shoot? I mean, if it was your first role, it must have been a little daunting.
No, DK, it was the reverse. It was a joy. That's one of the questions I get asked most by everybody. They go, what was it like filming Grease? You know, what was it like? It was like, DK, imagine the greatest party you've ever been to. Remember the greatest party of your life, the most fun party. Everybody was nice, pretty girls, great food, just the greatest, most fun blowout party of your life. Imagine that party, going to that party every day for 2 months. That's what it was like. Every day was a party. Everybody on the set was wonderful. The cast was wonderful. I loved our director, Randall Kleiser. The dancers were wonderful. John was the nicest guy in the world. Olivia was sweet. It was a joy. It was a joy every day. And, you know, I'm having a ball, and they're paying me for this. I got, like, I got scale, I think, DK, was like $450 at the time, $450 a week, which was, you know, not that much nowadays, but at that time, you know, I thought I was Ross Perot. I thought I was Rockefeller, you know. $450, wow, you know. And I'm getting paid to go in and have fun every day. So that was a joy.
Oh, brilliant. It does. I mean, even when you're watching the movie, it comes across, it looks like a very fun shoot, and the energy comes across in the movie. I mean, do you have any special...
Absolutely.
Do you have any special memories of that? Of the
shoot? Oh, my goodness. So many of them. I remember, well... This is how risque is your show, DK? Can I say a risque word on your show, or do you use it a clean family show?
No, you can say whatever you want, buddy.
Okay, the first time I talked to John Travolta, this is the first time I encountered John Travolta, I swear to God. I'm on the set, and we were talking. I had never heard the expression hard-on. I had never heard what hard-on. When I grew up in Maryland, we called them boners. When a guy gets, you know, excited about a woman, he has a boner. So I was talking to the guys, and I go, what's a hard-on? I go, when I grew up, they called them boners. And John Travolta happened to be walking by. And John goes, in New Jersey, they called him boners, too. That's what he said. So that was the first time I encountered John Travolta. Now, John was the sweetest, nicest guy in the world, totally nice. In fact, EK, we didn't keep in touch, but I was sick in 2001. I had a very bad sickness, and I happened to see John at the hospital. And he stopped me. He was in a car, and we talked, and we chatted, and he remembered me. He was just the sweetest, nicest guy ever. No pretension at all. And this is, you know, after Saturday Night Fever, he was the biggest star in the world. Yeah. Anyway, I got very sick again. I don't know if you know my history, but I had open-heart surgery in 2020. I had a lot of hospital bills in 2022. I had my open-heart surgery. My heart got infected. I got pneumonia, and I had a stroke. So I was in bad shape. Now, what I've heard, I've never verified it, but I've heard several people tell me, John helped pay for my hospital bills. He's such a sweet guy. He knew where I was in trouble. He paid for some of my hospital bills. So I trust that that's true. I've never been, because I don't know how to contact him now. You know, I guess I could write him, I guess. Hopefully he'd even get the letter. But that's the kind of guy he is. I don't disbelieve it, because I think he would do it. That's the type of guy he was. Just a sweet, wonderful guy. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. He sounds like a real stand-up
guy. Yeah, now Olivia I only talked to one day. One day I was on the Paramount lot, DK. I'm walking, I was there, Olivia was there, and there were two other guys. We were just goofing on the lot. And it was the only time I talked to her during the shoot. We were there, we got it, it was a goof, it was just a goofy thing. We got in this car and we hijacked it. It was a car and we drove around the Paramount lot. You know, we were young, we were all in our 20s, early 20s or late 20s. We were kids, you know. So we drove around the lot just as a lark. I thought, oh, we hijacked the car, that was funny. So anyway, I've been telling that story years ago. I hijacked a car. Olivia was in the front seat. She was in the front passenger seat. I was in the back passenger seat. She turned around to me and she goes, you're funny. And I said, thank you. That was the only time I talked to Olivia. But anyway, DK, I've been telling the story for 40, 45 years. And I was telling it to my manager, Steve. I go, you know, I hijacked a car with Olivia Newton-John. We rode around the Paramount lot. I never figured out, but we just must have got the keys and we hijacked. He goes, what color was the car? I go, it was a red car. He goes, idiot, don't you realize that was Grease Lightning? That was the Grease Lightning car. You probably got in the Grease Lightning car and you were driving around the Grease Lightning car. And I go, yeah, that would explain why they had the keys and why, because Olivia's nice. I don't think she's going to hijack a car. So we rode around the lot in Grease Lightning, and that was the only time I talked to Olivia. But that was a beautiful, wonderful memory I have of her. She was so lovely. And when she came out, DK, in the carnival scene, you know, she comes out in that black tight skirt, you know, that black tight pant and the outfit. The dancers, you know, showbiz, DK. The dancers, you know, almost all of them were gay. You know, they were lovely, wonderful guys. But, you know, they're mostly gay. They were dancers. And even they flipped. Every man on the set, our jaws dropped. It's like, I don't care if you're gay, straight. She was so beautiful, so gorgeous, such a knockout. We all just were mesmerized, you know. And she just looked so beautiful in that outfit. And,
Yeah, it is still a standout scene when she turns up in those black pants.
Exactly, when she turns up in that, and John has, the nerdy sweater. John looks like the nerd. It was
Yeah.
kind of a nice switch, and that's the number I heard in Deadpool today. I saw Deadpool, and they're playing that number, so of course the memories came flooding back into my head.
Did when you auditioned for it, did you
Yes.
have to do any singing for the role?
No, I actually didn't sing. In fact, I only sang in one song, BK. I sang in We Go Together. And I recorded them on the album. I didn't get any money from them. God, if I got residuals from the album, you can imagine how rich I'd be. The album's probably sold like, 80 bajillion copies. But I sang on We Go Together. I went in the studio and I sang. I'm the worst singer in the world, DK. I can't sing. I can't dance. I'm totally uncoordinated. But here's what happened to the audition. I went into the audition. Randall Kleiser was there, our director. Alan Carr, the producer. And our casting director was named, what was his name? Super nice guy. It was a real nice guy. Was a casting, but whatever. Anyway, the casting director was there. There were three of them there, and I did my. Eugene has about four lines. I go, "Hi, I'm Eugene." "Oh, thank you." That's about all I say in the movie. So I said my lines, and while I was doing my reading, I'm looking at script, and I could see they were nudging each other. The three of them were nudging each other with their elbow, so I could see that. And as an actor, they're nudging each other. That shows their interest. So I thought that was a good sign. And then I heard a couple days later they told me I got the role in Grease, so I'm over the moon. Now, let me ask you something, DK. Are you a religious person? Are you religious or are you secular?
I'm pretty kind of agnostic. I'm not sure one way or the other. I don't really
I
practice.
understand. By the way, I'm with you. I'm agnostic too.
Yeah.
I pray, and I do get the answers to a lot of my prayers, but I'm like you. I'm agnostic. But this is a very religious story, and this is 100% true story, but it's a very religious story. Now, I got the role from Grease. Of course, I'm over the moon. I called my parents. I'm in this movie with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. It's called Grease. It's my first film. I called all my friends. I'm in this movie called Grease with John Travolta. I couldn't believe it. It's like it was surreal. Anyway, a couple days later, DK, Paramount Studios called my agent. They said, "Eugene is a very small role. We're going to cut it out of the movie. We don't need Eddie anymore." So, of
Oh.
course, my agent called me. Of course, I wanted to jump off a cliff, you're
Yeah.
kidding me, right? You tell me I'm going to get my first movie with John Travolta, Grease, and now you tell you pull the rug out from under me. I'm not in the movie anymore. I wanted to kill myself, So my agent, she goes, "Eddie, we're going to go to church and pray." I go, "I'm Jewish, right?" She goes, "I know you're Jewish, okay." So she comes and picks me up. We drove to this little church in Hollywood. It's still there. It's called Our Mother of Good Counsel Church. It's off Hollywood Boulevard on Vermont Avenue. It's still there. It's a beautiful little church. We went in. She goes, "We're going to light candles." I'd never done this, but she gave me the candle. We each took a candle. She gave me some matches. We went to the altar. We both lit candles, and I prayed. I go, "Dear God, please let something good happen. This, please let me get out of this. Please let something good happen." DK, I swear to God, a couple days later, we got the call. She said, "Paramount called. She said they want you back in Greece."
Oh,
So that's a
wow.
true story. It's 100% true story. Now, I tell that story. I've been telling that story for almost 50 years. My religious friends go, "God answered your prayer. You got the answer to your prayer. It's a very religious story." My secular friends who are not religious or agnostic, they go, "You got a lucky break. You lucked out." So you can take the story however you want, but that's a true story. That's how I got Grease.
Oh, wow. That is good. I do like that. And no matter, whether you are religious or what, as you say, whether you're secular, is you certainly got the break.
Yeah, I got a break. I've been very lucky. I've been very blessed.
Do you ever keep in touch with your with any of the co-stars from Greece?
Not hardly any of them. I had a bit of, well, I don't want to get into it, but because he's the greatest guy, Barry Pearl is one of the T-Birds, and we had a little upset on Facebook. Little things can happen. Even among friends you love, you get into these little fights. We got into a little thing on Facebook. I posted something, and he said it was inappropriate, and I go, "It's my page," and we got into an argument, and I love Barry. I love him very much, but I know, I'm the one that got the Grease guys into doing signing shows. I was the first. I've been doing signing shows since 1982. And I did, dozens of signing shows with the Grease Gang. I love them all. I don't dislike any of them, and I'm not mad at Barry. But we kind of had a falling out, and I know Barry's doing the shows with them, so I don't do the shows with them anymore.
All
So,
right.
but I love all the cast. They were wonderful to me, and I'll never forget how kind they were to me. And Barry and I were best friends for 45 years. He was like a brother to me. So hopefully we'll get back as friends.
Oh, hopefully, yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I wasn't aware until you posted about it, but I had no idea a very young Michael Biehn was in the movie.
Yeah, Michael Biehn, who's in my favorite Western, Tombstone, which I, you know, that's one of my top 10 movies. It's, you know, your favorite movies, DK. You can watch them over and over and over 100 times and you never get tired of them, you know.
Definitely.
And that's, you know, I'm that way with The Hard Day's Night, my favorite movie. And I'm that way with, you know, Sylvester Stallone, First Blood. I'm that way with Tombstone. These are just movies, you know, you watch over and over. And I never get tired of Tombstone. And Michael was the sweetest guy. And DK, I was at the airport. This was maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. And I'm getting my luggage. Eddie, I hear somebody call out. I look around. It's Michael Biehn. I haven't seen him since Grease, you know. I saw him there. The sweetest guy in the world. And I go, you played such a miserable rat in Tombstone. It's a despicable, you know, a killer, a cold-blooded killer. And that's a tribute to what a great actor he is, you know. You know what I mean? That he could play, that a sweet guy like that could play such a rotten character. But that's what a good actor does, you know. That's what makes you a good actor.
Exactly, exactly. Speaking of music, and, you know, your love of Hard Day's Night, you went on to play a character in the movie I Want to Hold Your Hand. How was that one for you? I mean, you're a Beatles fan, so I imagine that was a really good role for you.
That was my third film. Yes, that was my third film, and that's where I came in contact with Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg was the mentor of Bob Zemeckis, Robert Zemeckis, who, you know, he's one of our greatest directors now. He did Forrest Gump, and, you know, he's done Castaway. He's done so many great movies. But this was his first movie. It was I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I'm the world's biggest Beatles fan. Now, I literally, this is my all-time record. I've been to hundreds of auditions, but DK, I auditioned for that film 9 times. I had 8 callbacks, 9 auditions, and finally I got it. It was a great joyous film. Bob Zemeckis to this day is my favorite director, and he, of course, you know, I did 1941 the next year, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and then years later he remembered me and he wrote me into the Polar Express. My character, you know, if you see the Polar Express book, the book of Polar Express, which people, you know, mothers read to their kids at Christmas, by Chris Van Allsburg, I'm not in it. Know It All is not in it. It's a character Bob just wrote for me and he inserted into the cast, but I'm not in the book. It just, he invented me for the movie. So Bob Zemeckis, I always owe him a debt. Steven Spielberg was a wonderful, wonderful guy. Steven and I remember walking around the hallways with him. We tried to talk about funny gags. And I came up with this joke. It's a joke you've heard now, but this was 1977 I wrote it. And I think this was the first time. But the scene where I go in the room, you know, and the cop is there. And he goes, "What are you, now I got you, little shit." And I go, "Who are you calling little?" I thought, you know, like this idiot, he says little. That's like, it's like an old joke now, but I made the joke and Steven Spielberg laughed and he took me in the room. He goes, "Bob, Eddie wrote this joke and he told me the joke. And who you calling little?" And that's the scene in the movie. That's the scene. That's the bit I wrote. But I made Steven Spielberg laugh. He was a great guy.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Nice. Another of your early roles. I don't know if many people know this, was in the movie Laser Blast, which has become...
Yes, Laser Blast was actually my second one. And I'll tell you a quick trivia. You're on my Facebook page. You're my Facebook friend. I'm the only actor in history, DK, to throw up at three of my first movies, on the set of three of my first four movies. On Grease, my last day on Grease, Alan Carr, the director, and Randall Kleiser, the producer, come up and they go, "Eddie, will you get on this twirly ride?" We were at the carnival, you know, we were shooting the carnival scene the last day. And I said, "I can't do that. I have a bad stomach. I'll get nauseous." And they kept talking to me. And I go, you know, what am I going to do? It's my first film. You got to, you know, if they say, you know, jump off a cliff, you're going to do it. It's your first movie. You have to obey what they say. So I got strapped in. I got on the twirly ride. Then I got off the ride. I was woozy. I signed out. This was my last day on Grease. I went across the street into a pasture and I threw up. That was my last day on Grease. I threw up my last day. Now, this was, I Want to Hold Your Hand. When we finished I Want to Hold Your Hand, Bob Zemeckis gave me a cigar to celebrate. It was December 21st, 1977. Eddie, we did a great job. We were real happy and proud with our film, you know, and he gave me a cigar. I didn't know, DK, that you don't inhale cigars. Cigars, you know, they're great, but you don't inhale them. You let the smoke whirl around your mouth and you spit it out. You blow it out. But I inhaled it. I got nauseous. I went to the toilet and I threw up. So that was my other one. And then we'll get into 1941. I'll tell you my throw-up story there. But I had... My first three films, I threw up. Three of my first four. Laser Blast is the only one of my first four films I did not throw up. Laser Blast, DK, it was a 3-day shoot. It was a little bit I had. It was my one bad guy. Well, you know, if you see Laser Blast, I'm aiding and abetting in a rape. The guy's a rapist, my friend Chuck. He's raping the girl, and I'm jumping on him, you know. So it was a gnarly character. It was a sci-fi film. It wasn't necessarily a comedy movie. I'm a comedian, you know, but that was a gnarly role. So I did that. The lead guy, Kim Milford, was a sweet guy. He later died of AIDS, unfortunately. I had a lot of friends I lost. You remember the AIDS? I don't know. How old are you, DK?
I'm 50.
Okay, I don't know if you remember the AIDS era, but AIDS was, before COVID, that was the most horrible, you know, epidemic, and I lost a lot of good friends. But Kim Milford was the lead guy, and we lost him to AIDS. He was, yeah, it was sad. Craterface, you know, Dennis C. Stewart, the guy in Greece. Craterface, you know, the villain guy who fights John Travolta. He died of AIDS, too. He was the first of the Rydell kids that died, but I lost him to AIDS, too. And he was a wonderful guy.
Oh, yeah. It took a lot of good people, that epidemic.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just like COVID, the same thing. Took a lot of good people.
Exactly. Laser Blast become something of a cult movie itself over the years. They even riffed it on Mystery Science Theater.
Mystery Science Theater is better. I like the Mystery Science Theater much better than the movie. The Mystery Science Theater version is hilarious. I love that.
Yeah. Have you got any kind of new fans approaching you since they riffed it?
You know, just use one Facebook. People see it. I think people saw it on Mystery Science Theater that didn't necessarily see the movie. I mean, that was my first really bad movie. That should have been my first movie, because most people, you know, Sylvester Stallone and, you know, Clint Eastwood, I think, did The Blob, you know. But you do usually B movies are your first film, because who's going to hire you for an A movie? But Laser Blast was my B movie, but that was my second movie.
Well, you've covered both B movies and you know, temple movies.
I've done both. And as you know, A movies are so much better that, you know, it's fun to increase. Polar Express was, you know, big budget. Those are fun. But B movies are kind of fun. It's kind of an adventure. You know, it's like you're doing a home movie with friends, you know. Yeah. Laser Blast, the budget was probably like, I would be surprised if it was more than $1 million. You know, it was probably, you know, it was super low. But, well, remember, Grease was only $6 million. Grease was a pretty low budget movie. And, you know, it's probably made, what, $500 million by now?
Yeah. Yeah, and you were so memorable, they asked you back for the sequel.
Yeah, I got asked back. I was asked back, Dee Dee was back, and Dennis, like we're talking, Dennis C. Stewart, Craterface was back, you know.
How was that? Did that differ any? Obviously, the main cast members had changed, but how was that shoot for you?
It wasn't as much fun. I went on the set the first day of Grease 2, DK. Maxwell Caulfield's there. Sweetest guy in the world. He is the sweetest, nice guy in the world. Eddie, would you like to come into my dressing room? We go into his room. He serves me tea and cookies. So we're having tea and cookies, the proper British. I'm thinking to myself, this movie is going to bomb so bad. This guy is going to replace. I mean, he was the greatest guy in the world. And by the way, I've seen him in TV shows. He's a very fine actor, Maxwell Caulfield. It's just the script. I go, they're replacing John Travolta with this genteel Britisher with tea and cookies. Just people, you know, girls want to see Danny Zuko. That's what they go to. So that's why Grease was it. Grease was a hit for a lot of reasons, but the main reason was John Travolta.
Yeah.
You know, John's dynamism, you know. And I knew it was going to bomb. Michelle Pfeiffer, I saw on the set one day. She was Marilyn Monroe, drop dead beautiful. It was like, it was like seeing a young Marilyn Monroe. She was that gorgeous. So I looked at her. I was in a trance, you know. I walked up to her. I go, you're beautiful. And she goes, thank you. That was the only time I ever talked to her during the whole shoot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She was just absolutely drop dead gorgeous. Got to be one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life.
Well, shortly after, you were cast in Spielberg's 1941, which...
1941, John Belushi,
Yeah, I mean, it had a John huge Candy. Ensemble cast. I don't think I'm out of line to say this. There were a lot of legends in that. How was that one for you?
That was so much fun to shoot. I loved... Oh, yeah, and I'll tell you my throw-up story. This was my fourth of the four movies. I was on the Ferris, you know, as you know, DK, you've seen it. I spend the whole movie pretty much on the Ferris wheel with my dummy. So Steven was whipping us around on the Ferris wheel real fast one day. And I felt nauseous. I called down Steven. I go down, I go, I feel nauseous. I feel sick. He goes, go in my dressing room and lie down. So Steven's lovely assistant was this beautiful girl. She took me in. I laid me down on Steven Spielberg's cot. So I'm laying there on Steven Spielberg's cot. I started to feel real nauseous. I crawled on my hands and knees to the bathroom. I threw up in his toilet. And I thought to myself, I just threw up in Steven Spielberg's toilet. I go, what an honor. I said, this is one of the highlights of my career. I threw up in Steven Spielberg's toilet. But I threw up in Steven's toilet. That was my sick day. John Belushi was the greatest, nicest guy in the world. He was just a lovely guy. The last time I saw him, DK, we filmed in the movie. He, by the way, he was a total pro. You hear these stories, you know, he was a drug-crazed idiot, you know, lunatic, you know, ripping up the stage and all that. He was a total pro there. I remember he was always on time from what I saw. I wasn't, you know, I've never been into the drug scene, so I didn't see that side of it. You know, there were probably people giving him drugs, who knows. But he was totally straight and a total professional when I was there with him. Anyway, I saw him years later, DK. I had an audition, and I had a really bad audition. So I went out, I was really depressed. This is like maybe, you know, I'd say maybe 2 years after 1941, a couple of, because remember, John didn't live that long after. John died in 82. 1941 came out at the end of 79, so he didn't live that much longer, which is so sad. But yeah, this is maybe a year later. I had a bad audition. I went out. I was real depressed. So who walks by John Belushi? I happened to run into him, you know, in Hollywood. You bump into these people, you know. Yeah. So I bumped into him. He goes, "What's the matter? Hi, Eddie, what's the matter?" I go, "I just had this audition. These people hated me. I did terrible, and they hated me." And he goes, "They're assholes." And he walked off. That was the last time I saw John Belushi. He just said, the last thing I heard him say was, "They're assholes." And he just walked off. That was John. He was a character.
Legend. Absolutely.
Oh, and my great lunch. DK. Yeah, DK, I got to tell you my greatest lunch. One day I'm on the set of 1941. Steven Spielberg walks up and he goes, "Hey, Eddie, you want to have some lunch with us?" "Sure. You know, I'll have lunch with Steven Spielberg. Sure." So we go into the commissary at MGM. It's me, Steven Spielberg's at the head of the table. I'm there. To my right is Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. So that's four of us. I'm having lunch with Spielberg, John Belushi, and Dan Aykroyd. I couldn't talk. You know, I was so overwhelmed. DK, I was a 22-year-old kid. You know, I was just barely out of high school. So I couldn't talk the whole lunch. I had my lunch. They were laughing and talking. And finally, we got the bill. The bill came. I realized I didn't have any money on me. But luckily, Steven picked up the tab. He goes, "This is on me." So Steven picked up the tab, and I didn't get embarrassed. But that was the coolest lunch of my life, even though I was so overwhelmed I couldn't talk.
I would imagine that when, you know, if someone gets to have lunch with you, they feel a similar kind of vibe, you know?
Well, you're very kind. Thank you. Somehow I think Spielberg could have it. Steven Spielberg is bigger than any actor, and he's probably the biggest name in showbiz. He's kind of like Elvis now. If there was Elvis, he's as big as Steven Spielberg.
That's true. His resume is pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. What a genius. What a talent. And he was the nicest, sweetest guy in the world. Again, the biggest stars I've met, no pretension, DK. They were all totally nice. They weren't, you know, you see movies and you see movie stars and you'll see the characters. They're always like prima donnas, you know. "Fetch me this. Get me my slippers." Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they're like ordering people out. The biggest stars I've met have all been the sweetest, nicest, most regular guys, no pretension. So that's just a total, you know, the Hollywood prima donnas, the big stars, they're not like that at all. The jerks, the assholes I've met have all been like the small time, you know, small potatoes people, you know. Yeah. They're like small time people you've never heard of and they never worked again. And luckily, they're in the minority. I'd say in all my career and all the years I've worked, I'd say 97% of people have been wonderful, nice, and there have been, you know, one or two or three assholes, that's all.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's a good treat to have. I mean,
yeah.
Looking around at your fellow cast members on that film, as you said, it's Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, there's John Candy, there's Lorraine Gary.
John Candy, who I love, yeah.
You're on Robert
I'm
Stack.
DK, John Candy was a lovely guy, sweetest guy in the world. Now, I saw him after 1941 again. I happened to bump into him in Hollywood. I was walking on Hollywood Boulevard. He was there with his manager. This is a simple story, but it shows what kind of a man he was. I was there with this manager. We were by Howard Johnson's. You know what? You remember Howard Johnson's, right? The ice cream place?
Yeah,
there was Howard Johnson's. It was a place where you go for ice cream. So I go in with John Candy and his manager, and we were having ice cream. We were having ice cream and just talking and chatting. John was just a lovely guy. Anyway, I started talking. I said whatever. I don't even remember what I said, but I was going, "Hey, John, it was great working with you, and I really..." And the guy, and he started laughing at me, the manager. He was just a little bit rude, you know, not necessarily a real asshole, but he was a little... And he was laughing, and he goes, "John, do you hear how he talks?" He was, like, laughing at me right in front of my face. I thought it was kind of rude, but, you know, whatever. And I'll never forget, John just ignored him. He's, like, talking to John, and, like, he was kind of, like, ridiculing me a little, but John just kept talking. And I remember just what a gentleman John was. If you can envision the story, and I just saw what a gentleman, what a kind man John... John Candy didn't have it in his heart to laugh at anybody. He would never do something like that. The manager didn't quite have John's class. He was kind of, like, laughing at me. It wasn't a real mean laugh, but he was, like, kind of making fun of me, you know. He goes, listen to him talk. He was going, you know... Which I won as a comedian, but, you know, you don't like to be ridiculed. You like to be laughed with, you know, or laughed at. But John was just a sweet guy, and that's the story I remember about him. Just a great, really nice guy, yeah.
Yeah, another one.
Dan Aykroyd, I'm sorry, go ahead, DK.
I was just going to say another person that sadly left us too soon.
Yes, way too soon. He was 43, huge loss. He was just the nicest, sweetest guy ever. He was like John Travolta, sweet, Tom Hanks, sweet. These are the sweetest, nicest guys in the world, and he was totally that way. Dan Aykroyd, I didn't talk to a lot. Dan Aykroyd, I remember he was very into UFOs, and we were talking on something, and I clearly remember he goes, "They're out there, Eddie." He goes, "They're out there." He was like, it's like you know, it's like you saying, telephone poles. There's a telephone pole out there, you know, or there's a bird flying in the sky. It was like, Ruthie, he was just saying it mattered. He goes, oh, they're out there, Eddie. Believe me, he's 100% certain there are UFOs. He's that sure. And he also loved badges. He would bring badges in, and he showed me some of his badges. He was very into collecting badges, and he loved UFOs. That's what I remember. And I remember what a nice guy he was, too. He was just a great guy. Highly intelligent guy, yeah.
Yeah. Going into 1941, it didn't quite mm-hmm. live up to expectation at the box office.
Yes. I mean,
some said it was too unrestrained. Others said it was unpatriotic. However, it's gained a really passionate cult following over the years. I consider
Absolutely,
it personally.
Yes, yes.
It's one of my favorite all-time movies.
Oh, thank you, DK. You're very kind. It's grown to me. When I saw it, I went to the premiere, and I was disheartened. I walked out of the theater, and I think I cried. I was really sad because I thought I had such high hopes. You know, how often do you get in a Steven Spielberg film? You know, so I'm in a Spielberg film. I'm 22, and I saw it, and the reviews came out, and I was so depressed. It got savage, you know. Now, it did ultimately make money. It didn't bomb. It marginally made money. It wasn't a big hit, but it made money. And you're right. It has a good following nowadays. People look at it in a different light now, I think. It's kind of an uneven film, you know. It's not smooth, you know. Jaws is like, if you watch Jaws, one of my favorite movies, it's like a perfect movie all the way through. It's totally polished. Everything's perfect. 41 is kind of disjointed. It's kind of choppy, you know, cutting thing to thing. So, and there's one scene, I don't know if you noticed, but I get asked about this all the time. There's one scene I'm on the Ferris wheel with my dummy. I'm on, like, the right side. And then there's another cut take where I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
They cut to the next scene. I'm on the other side. People ask, it was just bad editing. Just editing, maybe. There's a scene in it, DK, where I go, you know, Murray's like scared of heights. Murray's scared up there. And I'm on the phone, and I'm like this idiot. I'm not even thinking. And I go, hey, let me look over here. And I'm climbing over Murray, and he's real scared, you know. And I'm going, hey, let me. And, you know, the joke was this guy's terrified, and this idiot's climbing over him.
Yeah.
They cut that out for some reason. They edited that out. So that's why I was on the other side. I did climb over, but for some reason, they didn't include the scene where he climbed over him. So it just looked like Eddie and the dummy are there, Murray's on the side, and then wait, Murray's on the other side, and Eddie's on the other side. Why is that? How did the editor ever miss that?
Yeah, it does come across as bad continuity. I kind of figured that's what might have happened, but without the scene, it makes it hard to know. But I've got to say, every time I watch it, it never fails to make me laugh. Now,
good. Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you enjoy it, DK.
Oh, I love it. Looking back, do you feel the criticism, especially the thing about it being unpatriotic, was justified? And how do you feel on it getting that second life with fans these days?
Well, of course, I'm glad it has a second life. You know, it's like anybody. You want people to like. I want people to like my films. You know, that's what I want. I don't want them to dislike it. Anybody, you know, a carpenter or an artist, you know, I want people to like my handiwork, you know, whatever. A teacher, I want the students to like me. You know, everybody wants to be admired. Admiration is the name of the game, you know. That's why we're all playing it. We all want to be admired by women, by, you know, by friends, by our audiences, but admiration is the name of the game, and especially an actor, you know our egos, DK. That's why we got into the business. We want people to like us. That's why actors get in the business. We like performing. We want people to appreciate it. So I'm glad it has a second life. My tragedy, DK, here's the tragedy. They wanted who in that movie? John Wayne. Steven tried to get John Wayne to play the Robert Stack role, but John Wayne, like you said, he thought it was unpatriotic. He read the script. He said, this is too unpatriotic. I won't do it. I mean, to work with John Wayne, I would have fainted, you know, John friggin' Wayne, God. But John Wayne was offered, and he won. But he turned out, so that was my sad loss in that one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, going on from that, you then had a major role in the shortly after the Disney movie Midnight Madness.
Midnight Madness was, yes, Michael J. Fox's first movie, and it was my old friend Pee Wee's first movie. Michael J. Fox, this was Michael's first film. He wasn't even Michael J. Fox. You see, he's billed as Michael Fox. He later added the J. There was another actor, I think, called Michael Fox in Screen Actors Guild, and he had to add the J. But that's the only film I think he was billed as Michael Fox. And if you notice, Michael, of course, it was the whole cast. You know, there's like 30 of us in the cast. And Michael is the one guy who's not funny at all. His role is totally straight if you watch the movie. He's like a very serious, dramatic character. He doesn't do one funny thing. And he's the one that, you know, became the breakout comedy star, you know, with Family Ties and Back to the Future. He's a very funny comedian.
Yeah. Did the idea of appearing in a movie similar to It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World appeal to you?
I think that's what they based on, which is another of my favorite movies. I love that movie. I'm sure that, you know, there's been a couple, you know, there was Rat Race. There's been a couple movies like that, but it was one of the first takeoffs on Mad, Mad, Mad World. Yeah, Mad, Mad, Mad World, they had this all-star cast, And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But somehow this directory took these all these great comedians together, and everybody is great. Every single person. There's no bad at performances. Everybody's funny. Everybody has a great role. It's a totally enjoyable film. It's a laugh. It's the only, you know, DK, I was never in Jonathan Winters. He's just one of those movies that never made me laugh. It's the one movie or the one performance that Jonathan Winters I thought is great. He makes me laugh. But I never thought he was funny. Jonathan Winters, for some reason, just doesn't hit my buttons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but, I mean, some people are like that. It just can't be helped. I mean, speaking of that, you strike me as easily able to make friends. In that movie, with it being kind of like a madcap comedy, did you find that a fun one as a group?
No, this is the truth. I've done, I think, DK, like, you know, between 20 and 30 movies. I've done TV shows, you know, a lot of radio spots, cartoons. I've done so much work over these 45 years. That was my unhappiest experience. There were a few real jerks in that movie that were not nice. I won't tell you names. Some of the jocks weren't that nice to me. One of the jocks would bait me all the time. I had filmed 1941, and he'd come over. He thought it was funny or whatever, but he'd always go, 1941's going to bomb. And he'd keep baiting me like that, and I didn't like that. And they just weren't real nice to me, some of them. It was my unhappiest shoot. Now, I want to make sure you know, Pee Wee Herman was great. I love Pee Wee. We were friends from the word go. Michael J. Fox was great. Maggie Roswell, I love. David Naughton was wonderful. So I'd say almost all the cast was good. But it's like almost every movie I work on, our TV show, we're all friends. It's like, you know, you get onto a movie and you're like, you know, a troop going in the army together. We're all comrades. You know, we're on this, you know, we all have the same purpose. We want to make a good movie. We want everybody to look good. And we're on the same team. But for some reason on that movie, some of the guys weren't that nice to me. Oh. I didn't like being baited about 1941, you know, but these guys were assholes, a couple of the jocks, you know, that's all. Some of the bigger guys, and I couldn't do anything. They were big guys, you know. Yeah. If I was a tough guy, I'd go, you know, I'd put them in their place. But that was my unhappiest movie that way.
Oh, fair enough. Jumping forward, you made a memorable appearance in the 1983 John Badham movie, which itself has become something of a cult movie. I understand the movie obviously is War Games. I understand that you didn't work with Badham himself on that one, though. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I worked with Marty Brest, who the next year did Beverly Hills Cop, so he got out of it good. But the studio, I think it was MGM, they didn't like his dailies. They looked at Marty's dailies, and he directed me in my scene, and they didn't like his dailies. He had 12 days, and they fired him, and they brought in John Badham. John Badham looked at all the dailies, and mine was the only scene he liked, the scene I'm in with Matthew and my partner, Maury Chaykin, where he calls me Mr. Potato Head. That was the only scene he liked. So it's the only scene in the movie not directed by John Badham, and I never met John Badham to this day.
Oh, wow. Do you know if the movie, I mean, did you get a script? Do you know if the movie changed significantly from the one you signed on to do, or was it pretty much as is?
You know, I don't remember the whole script. I just remember my scene. I didn't read the whole script. I got a script. I think it was, we later sold it in a show or whatever, but all I remember is my scene. I didn't read the script, so I don't know. I'm not even sure what scenes, you know, what scenes did John redirect that Marty did. I don't know. I don't know what his 12 days of work were.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, again, you've mentioned Maury, but, I mean, you work with some standout names in there. Matthew Broderick, Ali Sheedy, you know, as you said, Maury. Do you have any fond memories from that shoot?
Well, the tragedy, I'll go into the fond memories, but just the tragedy real quick. You said we're some great people. You know, they wanted for Falcon, you know, in that movie, they wanted John Lennon. They wanted to hire John was the original idea, and then, of course, the tragedy happened. So it was the other, and the other guy was great, you know, whatever that man's name was. He was very good. But can you imagine being in a film with John Lennon? I would have paid them, you know, but
yes, that
was just a pipe dream that never happened. I've had a lot of close calls like that, too, that, you know, just miss working with him. But the fond memory is Matthew Broderick was the sweetest guy ever. I rode to the set with him in the morning. We picked him up, and I was in the front seat, and we picked Matthew up. He was sitting in the back seat behind me, and he was talking about his dad. His father, James Broderick, was an actor, and he had just died around that time. Matthew was telling me about his dad, how much he loved him, and I turned back to look at him, and he had tears in his eyes. It was a very sweet scene. I realized, what a sweet kid. You know, he was a kid. He was like 21 at the time, you know, and he's starring in this major movie, you know, and that kind of started his legend, this movie. Matthew Broderick, we all know, you know, he's a superstar, but that was like his first big hit, I think, before Ferris Bueller, and PG talked about his dad. He was great. Now, we go to the set. Matthew and I were there. Ali Sheedy, I knew. I had done a pilot with her at Paramount. We did a pilot that never sold, but I knew her already, and I knew her boyfriend was Eric Stoltz, who I did a film called Surf 2 with.
Oh, yeah.
And he later did Mask. You know, he was the guy in Mask, the kid in Mask.
Yeah.
But I knew her. She was very sweet. I would play poker with Eric at Eric's house. We'd play poker with a bunch of Surf 2 guys. And she would come in and say hi. See, I'd come in from shopping. She was dating Eric at the time, so I knew her. But I met Morty Chaikin. And he was, you know, a nice guy. I should have seen. He goes, listen, I'm going to call you Mr. Potato Head in this scene. He made it up. It wasn't in the script, but Mr. Potato Head. And I go, that's great. That's brilliant. And that's what I'm known as. To this day, people call me Mr. Potato Head, you know. But that was Maury's invention. It wasn't in the script. And he said that we're going to run through the scene. Let's rehearse. And he put me in my place, DK. He goes, let's rehearse. I go, that's no big deal. It's just one scene. And he goes, it's a big deal to me. He goes, well, it's a big deal to me. And he put me in line. You know, I wasn't being professional. He wanted to rehearse, so, you know, you rehearse. So we rehearsed the scene. We did it, and, you know, a couple times. Anyway, that put me in my place and made me be more disciplined. But here's the thing. Marty directed me, and I kept screwing up the scene. I kept saying the words data encryption algorithm. I kept screwing them up. We would do a take. We'd do the scene perfectly, and I'd go, yeah, it's a new data endocrine algamine. And I'd cut, and they'd go, cut. Then we'd do take two. We'd do the scene perfectly. The new data crism algorithm. And I would screw up, and I screwed up about 10 or 12 times. So Marty Brest called me over. He puts his hand around my shoulder. He goes, Eddie, let's take a walk. So we take a walk out into the lot. You know, he goes, look, he goes, you're costing the studio a lot of money. You keep screwing up the scene. He goes, we're going to get you idiot cards. He said idiot. He pronounced the idiot a lot. He goes, we're going to get you idiot cards. Like, he's looking at me and saying that. It's a subtle message, you know. So we got, you know, it's cue cards. So this was the first time I ever used cue cards. Before this, I would always, you know, if I'd get a role in a movie, 1941 or whatever, I'd go in my room, I'd lock myself in my room, I'd go over my lines, you know, for a couple hours over and over, and I'd memorize my lines. This is the first time I couldn't remember lines, and I realized how great cue cards are. So we got cue cards, and we go action, and I read, oh, the new data encryption algorithm. I read it. We did it in one take, bang. A snap. I go, these are great cue cards. I fell in love, you know. Now, when we did Polar Express years later, the whole film I did on cue cards. But I said to Bob, I can't remember all these lines, and, you know, can we use cue cards? And he said, yeah. So he got me a cue card holder. I heard a rumor it was actually Bob Hope's cue card holder we got. I don't know if that's true, but a guy held cue cards for me the whole movie, and I read my whole role, Polar Express. Polar Express, we acted it out like a movie, but I used cue cards, you know. Yeah. Then the last day of filming on Polar Express, Tom Hanks, the last day, we're all done. And he goes, what the fuck are you using cue cards for? Why do I need fucking cue cards? He said, it's the last day. And my roommate, Freddie, he goes, yeah, he didn't want to introvert. You know, he let you do it for 11 weeks. We worked on it for 11 weeks. And then the last day, he said he was letting out his real emotions. I think for Tom Hanks, he's so good. He's so professional. He's such a natural. He couldn't imagine somebody needing cue cards, you know. But, you know, we're all different. I needed cue cards. I couldn't remember my life. But, you know, he's done Shakespeare. You know, he's done all these roles. He never needed them. But for me, I needed them.
Yeah. It's... People have, you know, I couldn't remember anything. I would need cue cards myself, so, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to. That's why I like doing voiceovers, DK. Voiceovers, they just give you a script and you just read it. You don't have to memorize anything. So I love doing, you know, voiceovers, cartoons, I love doing. Yeah. Anyway, I'll tell you one more Mr. Potato Head story real quick. I don't know if you heard this one, but this is a great story. We were doing a signing show this a couple months ago with my friend Rich. Now, we have a policy at signing shows when I do them with Stevie or when I do them with Rich, whoever I do them with, if there's a handicap, you know, if there's an alternately challenged person, somebody in a wheelchair or a blind person, we'll always give them a free picture.
Yeah.
So when I'm doing the show, this guy comes in walking. He has no legs. He's walking on his hands. It's a torso. He has two arms and a head, but there's no legs. So he's walking on his hands. You know, he would walk on his hands. And he had these huge, muscular, big, strong arms because he walks on his hands.
Yeah.
And I see him there, so I call him over. I go, sir, excuse me. He goes, oh, Mr. Potato Head. So he knew me from War Games. But I go, sir, if you want a free picture, please feel free to come up and get a free picture. He wasn't at our stand then, but I ran from my stand. So then about 15 minutes later, he comes up to my stand. So I go, sir, oh, hi, good to see you. And he walks in on his, you know, his hands, no legs. I said, please pick a picture. I'll sign it. So he looked around. He took a picture. It might have been from War Games or whatever. And I signed the picture. I gave it to him. You know, he put it under his arm. I forget how he walked with it. He might have had a bag around his neck. But he walked off on his hands with my picture. And I go, that was nice. Did you see that guy had no hands? He called me Mr. Potato Head. He knew me from War Games. And my friend goes, don't you know who that was? I go, no, who was it? He goes, that was E.T. That's the guy that plays E.T. I forget his name, but the guy that played E.T., that was that guy. He was signing at the show, and it was E.T. I gave a picture to E.T. He knew me from Mr. Potato. You could Google whatever his name is, but that's his name. He was a real nice guy.
Oh, that's fantastic. So E.T. is one of your fans.
Yeah, E.T. knew me. Anyway, yeah, so it was very cool, yeah.
Now, Some actors, they adopt a persona to delineate between themselves and their characters. How much would you say
Yes.
of Eddie there is in the roles that you've worked on over the years?
Great question. I'll say it. My character in the movies is 50 or 60% really me. I'm probably more serious. I'm not quite that goofy, but I want to hold your hand. I played a Beatles fan. That's pretty much how I am with the Beatles. And I can get real geeky, I'm not good with women. So a lot of it is me. I'm kind of a nerdy guy. I love to read, I love books and all that. But yeah, he might be a little more aggressive than me. I based a lot of my character on Daffy Duck. He was my hero. And I'm not quite that aggressive in real life. So I'd say 60% me, 40% is fictional.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I noticed that you like to read a lot. You must have a huge library.
Yes, well, not anymore the library so much. I've read thousands and thousands of books, but I was in LA 41 years, and remember, I left LA, so I didn't bring all my books with me. So I used to have a room that, what you're right, it was like a library. I had hundreds and hundreds of books, but then I left LA, I'd already read them, so there was no real reason to keep them. I think I donated them all to a library.
Oh, wow.
I donated to the library, I remember, and they said, "We don't take donations." I'm like, "Are you serious? I want to give you
Jeez.
these great books, these Beatles books. You don't want them." So I think what I did is I went outside, I just left them at the library. I think they must have got them. But is that the stupidest thing you ever heard? A
That's
library that won't take donations, that are free books. They
crazy.
were in good condition, So yeah, it was stupid. I don't know why they had it, but I left them at the library. Hopefully they got them.
Oh, hope so. Maybe someone.
Yeah, in my room now. I have maybe like 50 books in my room now, if that.
Do you sell them as you read them, or do you have you got back into
No, I
collecting?
pretty much have these. The ones out here I have. I mean, if somebody wanted them, I'd probably just give them to them. But I have, a lot I've read. I'm reading a Woody Allen book now, and I have a few in store. There's a Shemp book here, a Jerry Lewis book, several Beatles books I have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Elvis book. Yeah.
Cool. Maybe someone passed the library and just found it was their lucky day. Maybe there's someone listening in that's treasuring those books right now.
Yeah, you're right. Hopefully somebody got them, and they gave them enjoyment. I can't, I mean, it would be such sacrilege if they just threw them all away, if
Oh,
somebody
yeah.
found some garbage guy and threw them away. I hope that didn't happen, but whatever. It was 2016, so it happened a while ago.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about the voiceovers. You've done a lot of voice acting over the years, from Dexter's Lab and Kim Possible to Star versus the Forces of Evil and SpongeBob. How do you find the voice
Right.
acting in comparison to being on screen?
Oh my God, it's so much easier. I like doing on screen better because I like being in the movies. That's my goal. But I used to with voiceovers. I used to do something I don't even know if they have anymore. They're called radio spots. I used to do a lot of radio spots. We would go shopping at First National Bank, and I played a husband or whatever, or a son, and I would do those roles. I don't know if they even have radio spots anymore because I don't hear them that much anymore. But I would do those, and voiceovers are easy because, like I said, you don't have to memorize lines, so I like that about them. But the ego of me, the joy of acting is them seeing. I like them to see my movements. You get to get dressed up in your wardrobe. You get to interact with other actors, so I like that. Voiceovers, often you're in a booth alone. You'll be in a booth alone, and you'll just do your wild lines, and you record them, and you don't even see the rest of the cast. So I like movies better for my ego, but as far as easier, voiceovers are a piece of cake. You
Yeah.
just read a script. You don't have to memorize. You don't get in makeup. You don't get in wardrobe, and it's easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a favorite show that you've worked on?
I would say Dexter's Laboratory, definitely. When we do shows, there are tons and tons of Mandark fans, Dexter's Laboratory fans. When we do, an animation show or a pop culture show, that's often our biggest seller. When Stevie and I did a show about a month ago, that was our biggest seller, was the Mandark pictures.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, this voice acting, it led you've mentioned it earlier, but it led to you being cast in Robert Zemeckis' Polar Express alongside Tom Hanks, and
Right.
it's a beloved movie to many. I mean, it's a regular in our house during the holiday season. Can you
Oh, thank you.
oh no thank you, sir, honestly. Can you tell us a little bit on how that came about?
Well, my character is not in the book. The Polar Express book, if you get it, it's a classic children's book. I'm not in it. I had done the first film with Bob Zemeckis, a film in 1977. My first film was Grease, And then I did the Laser Blast low budget. My third film was called I Want to Hold Your Hand. This was, I played the character closest to me. You said, how are your characters, you know, compared to the real you? This, I played a crazed Beatle fan. It's about the Beatles coming to America in 1964. And I played a character called Ringo Klaus. I played a Beatles nut, you know. And I got to work with Bob. It was his first film. It was the first film Steven Spielberg ever produced. I met Steven on that film. And then the next year, he put me in 1941 with John Belushi. So that's how he knew me. Yeah. But, you know, he wrote me in. Bob Zemeckis made up the know-it-all character. You have Chris Van Allsburg wrote the book, but Chris had nothing to do with my character. Bob made up the, you know, the know-it-all character. His name is Lenny, actually, but it's not mentioned in the movie. Mm-hmm. But the know-it-all guy is Lenny, and he made, you know, this obnoxious kid, you know, and Bob wrote the character for me. So I love working with Bob. He's my favorite director, and he was a joy to work with. Tom Hanks is my favorite actor. He was incredibly cool. The first day on the set, we were all there. There was like 100 of us lined up. We were in a line. And I got word Tom Hanks is going to star in this film. I didn't even know till that moment. I'm going, are you kidding me? So Tom Hanks comes bouncing in the room. He puts out his hand. He goes, hi, Eddie, I'm Tom. He goes up to me first. He goes, hi, Eddie, I'm Tom. I'm thinking, no shit, Sherlock. Are you serious? Tom Hanks shakes his hand. And you see, he was such a great guy, such an incredibly great guy. He, like, bumped a cup. He's a charmingly delightful guy. He's like Tom Hanks. He's the biggest star in the world. But he comes up and he knocks something over, like a klutz, you know, like a nerd or something. Yeah. He knocks something over on the way and he picked up. And I thought, this guy's so warmly human, you know. He's the biggest star in the world, but he still knocked over this cup. And he picked up the cup and then he shook my hand. And I got to know him. And he was great. Anyway, the first day we did a table read. And I was, you know, scared out of my wits. I was overwhelmed. I'm like Ralph Cramden, you know. I'm going, humming, humming, humming. Tom Hanks is sitting across from me, you know. I didn't say a word. We read the script, you know, and people were talking, but I was too scared to talk to him. So I got home that night, DK, and I go, look, you're going to be working with this guy for 11 weeks. You better get some courage. You grow a pair, and you got to talk to this guy. So the next day we were there, we were all talking, and I go over, and I just said, the first thing that came to my head, I go, are you religious? I said, you're a nice guy. Are you religious, Tom? And he goes, yes, I'm very religious. I'm Greek Orthodox. I converted, you know, because of my wife and blah, blah, blah. But that was the first thing I asked him. He answered me. He gave me a very in-depth question. He didn't brush me off. I said, are you religious? And he gave me a long, detailed answer why he's religious. And I forget what else he said, but he said he's Greek Orthodox. I know that. And now we got to be good friends, you know. We got to be pals on the set. The first day on the set before the first shot. Now, here's what we did, DK. On the set, we'd all get in scuba suits. It was four of us. It was me, Tom, Nona Gay, the hero girl,
yeah,
the brave girl, whatever her name is. She's Marvin Gaye's daughter, you know. And the other guy was Peter Scolari, who was with Tom in Bosom Buddies. I had worked with Peter Scolari on I think it was a pilot we worked on together, some show, and he was a wonderful guy. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago, and I miss him. He was great. But he knew Tom, and it was the four of us. Every day we go on the set, the four of us would get into scuba suits. We get dressed in scuba diver suits. They put scuba divers' caps on our head, and they put these dots on our face. They mark these dots, and they put these little electronic things on our face. They look like a bunch of freckles, you know?
Yeah.
And that was called motion capture. They'd film us with a special kind of camera, and it was called motion capture. We would act out the scene, and then they had four little kids of us. They had a little Tom, little me, little Nona, little Peter. They would act out the same scene after we did it. I'd go, you know, I want all those presents, Santa Claus. And they'd go, cut. That was our scene. Then the little kids, they had a little kid, me, and he'd go, I want all our presents, Santa Claus. They'd act out the scene like us. And they morphed our bodies together into kids' bodies. That's how they did it. It's like our movements, but kids were doing the movements too, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that weird to
see?
It's
probably way more refined now, you know. This is 20 years later, so I'm sure it's more refined now.
Yeah, I mean, how did you find the whole Polar Express experience?
Oh, I loved it. Everybody was great. This was really first class. I mean, we catered food. We got great food at the studio. You know, they bring us this delicious food. But every Thursday, Tom would bring us in deli food. He'd bring it himself. He paid out of his own pocket. It was called Langer's Deli. And he'd bring us in corned beef sandwiches, pastrami sandwiches, potato salad, kosher pickles, you know. Every Thursday, we'd have a feast like that. And Tom treated us to it. Then one day, I noticed I was eating my corned beef sandwich. And I noticed Tom wasn't eating anything. We were all eating except Tom. And I went to Tom's secretary. I go, why isn't Tom eating with the rest of us? She goes, Tom has a bad jaw. He can't chew the food. It hurts his jaw. So the guy would buy us this big extravagant lunch, but he wouldn't eat it himself. You know, he's just that kind of a guy.
Oh, wow. He does come across as a nice guy. So it's nice to see that, you know, it's not, because some people, you know, that it's kind of a front. But it's not always nice when you hear that people really are that good.
Yes, he's really that good. He's, and the same with John Travolta. He's really that nice. It's not a front at all. I've met a few stars that were really mean. You know, they come across nice. They're really not so nice. But those two were both as nice as you imagine.
That's brilliant. I mean, you did mention last time before the recording messed up something about Captain Kangaroo while you were talking about...
Yeah. Well, you are you all Britain? You've lived in Britain your whole life or what?
I have, yes. So I don't know Captain Kangaroo, but I know of it.
Yeah, it was a kiddie show called Captain Kangaroo. He was called Captain Kangaroo because he had these big pockets. Interestingly, he dressed kind of like a conductor, like the conductor in the Polar Express. But he had these big kangaroo pockets, and they called him Captain Kangaroo. He had a friend called Mr. Green Jeans, and they had Mr. Moose. It was like this kiddie show, you know?
Yeah.
And he would sing, and he'd, you know, show little things. And he had a talking clock and all this stuff. But anyway, this was the first show I loved as a kid. Before kindergarten, I was like 5 years old, 6 years old. I would watch Captain Kangaroo every day, and then I'd go to kindergarten. It was the first TV show I fell in love with, you know? And we all know, you know, your first TV show you love, it's like the first girl you fall in love with. You never forget it. So I loved that show. It meant a lot to me. Anyway, we're filming Polar Express. It was early in 2004. And one day I read in the paper, Captain Kangaroo died, or I heard that Captain Kangaroo died. So it broke my heart. You know, I go, oh my God, Captain Kangaroo died. This guy I loved as a kid. I never got to meet him, but he meant so much to me, you know? So I got on the set. I was in makeup and I was real depressed and gloomy. I was so sad. So Tom comes in the makeup room. He goes, Eddie, did you hear Captain Kangaroo died? So obviously Tom knew him too. Tom watched him as a kid too. You know, this was a big thing in America. We love Captain Kangaroo. It wasn't as big as the Beatles in Britain, but we love Captain Kangaroo in America. Yeah. I don't know if you had a comparable show to that in England, a kiddie show, but we loved it. And, you know, Tom and I shared our memories. We said how we loved Captain Kangaroo, how we'd watch him every day. You know, you have breakfast, you eat your cereal and you watch Captain Kangaroo. And, we talked. And I felt kind of sad, even though talking to Tom helped. So anyway, they were done my makeup. I left the room. It was a real sunny day. I walked out of the room. I'm outside, and I hear this guy behind me. Somebody's walking behind me. I looked around. I'm looking into the bright sun. It was Tom Hanks. Tom and I are in our scuba suits. We're both in scuba suits with scuba hats on our heads, and we have these dots on our face. So I see Tom Hanks there. Tom is a big guy. He's like about 6'2", 6'1", 6'2". I'm about 5'9", or 5'10", so he's bigger than me. So I was looking up at him. I'm looking at this figure up in the sun, and spontaneously he sings me the Captain Kangaroo song. Now, you can go to YouTube when you hear it. It's called the Captain Kangaroo song, and you hear him sing the song. It's a stupid kiddie song. It goes, I'm Captain Kangaroo. Oh, no, you know what it was, DK? It's called the Tom Terrific song. That was a cartoon on Captain Kangaroo. It's called the Tom Terrific song. He was like a little cartoon, and they would play the cartoon on the show. So Tom sang me the song. He goes, I'm Tom Terrific, and this is my dog, Mighty Dog. And he sang me the entire song, DK. Aww. Word for word, verse for verse, the entire song. I just sat there. I wanted to cry. You know, it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Looking up into the sun, he's singing me this song from my childhood. You know, I haven't heard the song in like 40 years, you know, and he's singing it to me. Then he just stands there. He didn't say a word. He just stood there. It was surreal. And I just said what was in my heart. I go, you know what? You're a great guy. I go, you're a great guy. And DK, he just walked off. He didn't say a word. He just walked off like the Lone Ranger, you know. And I wanted to cry. It was the most beautiful moment of my life. So that was the day Tom serenaded me. Anyway, we did the Polar Express. When we finished it, he goes, Eddie, I hear you're a baseball fan. I go, yeah. He goes, you want to come to a Dodger game with me? So he took me to a Dodger game. We went to 3 Dodger games together. And I don't know if you read my post today, but about the national anthem, you know, the Star Spangled Banner.
Yes, I did.
But Tom, we would sing the national anthem. You know, it was Tom, me, and about 10 other people. We sat in his box seats, and, you know, they play the national anthem before the game. So I would sit by Tom, and we sang the national anthem together, and that was a real thrill. And then the 7th inning, they played Take Me Out to the Ball Game. They played at an American Ball Game, and we sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game. You know, so I got to sing with Tom, too. That was fun.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, you have worked with a lot of kind of big names, but... Without, you know, putting anybody else down, because, you know, who's been your absolute favorite to work alongside? Is there anybody that stands out?
Oh, God. Well, I love Tom. I love John Travolta. They would be my two favorites. Steven Spielberg, I work with as a director. He was a wonderful, kind man. Super, super nice guy. Wonderful. Oh. A truly kind man. He was a really kind man. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, further to that, you always seem to find time for your fans. I mean, together with what you post on, you know, Facebook, on social media, you yourself genuinely come across as an optimistic soul. And what gives you that view in life?
I do believe in karma. I do. Steve and I always, when Steve and I do shows, you know, we want to make as much money as we can, but we always go, you want to make the customers happy. We want them to always leave our table happy. And I like to make my friends happy. I love my Facebook friends, you know. I went through that rough spell, you know, in 2022 where I was put on a lot of meds. I had my heart surgery and I was put on a lot of meds. And I did some terrible things because I was on these meds, you know. They, like, turn you into Mr. Hyde, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came back to Facebook after that, and all my friends pretty much took me back, with the exception of one guy, one mean guy. But everybody else except me, and I, you know, I owe my friends a lot. Facebook means a lot to me because I was always a compulsive writer, DK. I can't stop writing jokes. I like to write gags and stories, and I love to read, and I love trivia. So I would always write stuff. Before they had Facebook, I had an email list. I had, like, about 100 or 200 friends, and I would send out daily emails to them. I'd send out my stories and my pictures and all, and that was email. Then with Facebook, you know, with Facebook, I could send out to 5,000 people. So I appreciate my friends and I love them. It gives me a catharsis to be able to do that. And I like to make people happy. It's a joy, you know. Steve and I do the shows, and, you know, you see these people's smiling face. They, you know, it's pretty much the, they all say, you know, you were part of my childhood. I love the Polar Express, you know, Grease. I've seen Grease 300 times or whatever they say. And I listen to them carefully, you know, and it's fun that you've made these people happy. You know, you've brought these people joy. It's a joy. It's an indescribable joy.
Fantastic. Yeah, you've just touched upon it, but you did have a health scare in recent years. If it's okay to ask, I mean, you know, what kind of happened there, and how has it affected your outlook?
Well, I had the open heart surgery, okay? I had the open heart surgery, and there were complications. I got pneumonia. My heart became infected, and something else. Oh, I had a stroke. So I was in bad shape, and they put me on all these meds. They put me on all these antidepressants, you know, without my permission. I've led a very anti-drug life. I'm very anti-drugs. You know, I don't believe in it for myself, but I am a libertarian. I believe if you want to take them, that's your business. You know, it's your body. You can do what you want. But as for me, I don't like them. But they took, you know, they gave them to me without my permission. And I didn't even know I was on them. And they put me on a regimen of 20 meds a day. You know, my friend Mary Ellen told me, she knew a nurse who was with me. And she said, Eddie's on this regimen of 20 pills a day, and he's not doing well. They're, you know, he's acting weird. But they, you know, I had to keep taking them. I don't remember hardly anything. My memory is so bad from this time, you know, but I did mean things. I called waitresses names, and I had this run-in with a waitress, and I was mean to my sister. I did some real bad stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, then eventually I weaned myself off the pills. I got off them. But that was a terrible period for me. When I was put in jail for a month. You know, I was in jail for a month, and then I was put in this mental hospital for 8 months. So it was really rough. I'm Jewish. I was in a room with 12 guys, 19 other guys. There were 20 of us. 17 of the guys were black Muslims.
Oof.
So it was kind of weird, but they were nice enough guys. They never really gave me trouble.
Yeah. I do remember you talking about you having some heart problems at the time, and I think you mentioned in that you had a situation in an airport that kind of, it might have been an airport, I'm not sure, where you had to run for something, and...
Yes, you're right, I had to run for a plane. I remember pulling something. Yeah, you're right. I was running for a plane or something. I remember, it's funny you mentioned that. I had forgot about that. I was running for a plane or something, and I pulled a valve out. I think that's what did it. I was running, and I pulled a valve. I was born with a heart murmur. When you know, when you listen to a person's heart, you know, with a stethoscope, it goes, dub.
Yeah.
And my heart, when I listened to him, the doctor said, you've got a heart murmur. He told me this years ago. He goes, listen to your, and I listened to my heart, and it would go, shh, dub. It would like that. And he said, you have what's called a heart murmur. One of your valves isn't fully connected to your heart. And he said, you can go through your life that way, but I think that day at the airport is what pulled it out. You're right. That's what started it. And then eventually I was leaking blood into my brain. I started feeling weak one day or woozy. And I went to the doctor. He said, you're leaking blood into your brain. Your valve has come loose. The blood that's supposed to be there is leaking into your brain. That's why you feel weird. So they said, we have to get you into surgery real quick. So January 6, 2020, I got my heart surgery. I got double bypass or triple bypass, whatever. I got that, and then trouble started. Then finally in 2023, I got out of the hospital finally. But it was a tough 2 years. My mom died while I was in the hospital. I couldn't, you know, my mom was my best friend, and they wouldn't let me out of the hospital to go to her funeral, so I didn't get to say goodbye to my mom. That was the worst.
Oh, goodness.
And then Olivia died. Olivia died a month later. Yeah, and I was in a car, and one of the nurses, she goes, Eddie, one of your friends died. I go, who? They're like, well, what do you mean? They go, Olivia Newton-John just died. This was a month after mom. And I loved Olivia so much, you know, so that was the worst year of my life.
I can imagine. Is everything okay now with regards to your health? Are you pretty
Yes.
much all clear?
Yes, I feel. I mean, I'm going to get an exam on the night. It's like March, I think, 19th or something like that. They're going to have a doctor come examine me. I haven't had a full exam, but I feel really good. Hopefully, everything will be good.
Good. Knock on wood for that one. So hope you stay healthy, my friend.
Thank you.
You mentioned your mother. I mean, you talk about her with great affection. Does she help inspire your views on life?
Absolutely. I think about her every day. My sister, I'm very close to my sister now. She's kind of replaced my mom, but mom, DK, we were at a show. We did it like last weekend. Stevie and I did a show, and this lady came in, with her son, and he was autistic. And he had a 1941 Chevy. He loved 1941. And she just goes, "You pick whatever pick. We're selling pigs for $40 a piece." And she goes, "Do you want that one, Billy? Whatever, I forget his name." She goes, "You want that one, Billy? Do you want this one?" And the kid picked out about six pictures, and he gave me his grease book to autograph. She totally indulged him. She's like doing everything for this kid. And I said, "You're the greatest mother in the world. You remind me of my mom. That's what my mom did. My mom would take me to a store, a bookstore, and she'd go, 'Which books do you want?' And I would get 10 books or whatever, and she'd buy me the 10 books. She did everything for me. She was my closest friend. I could always confide in her. She was an angel. She was a wonderful lady, and she was so nice to me. She spoiled me so much. I'll never replace her.
My mother, she's still with me, thank goodness. Again, knock on wood. And
Oh, you're lucky.
she's the same, and she's a big fan of yours, so
Oh, please give her my love.
I will do. Thank you. Now, you do tell a lot of jokes on your social media. Does that come naturally, or do you occasionally have to kind of brainstorm what to post the next day? I mean, it's certainly
Oh,
something I couldn't
definitely. I'll
do,
bring some.
so yeah, how easy is that for
Well,
you?
here's the thing. I have notebooks full of them, so I have backup. But I have like five or six notebooks, or just all my writing, so I can always look back. A joke I used 2 years ago, they're not going to remember now. So I'll recycle some jokes. But I will, what you said exactly. I'll sit in my bed and think, or I'll listen to the radio. I listen to music all the time. I like oldies, and I'll hear a song, Elvis or Diana Ross or Carole King, and I'll hear a lyric and I'll go, okay, let me make a pun on that, and I'll go down the alphabet of the pun, whatever it is. I hear a symphony, I'll go, I beer a symphony, or I don't wait till a pun happens, and I'll go, okay, I'll do that. Then what would fit that pun? What profession? And I'll manufacture the joke like that. I do that a lot because there's so many songs, so I'll do a lot of plays like that, or a catchphrase from a movie, like that, Grease is the word. I'll say, what would be grease is the bird or whatever, or crease is the word or something like that.
Do you consider it work?
It's a joy. I love doing it. It is, I mean, it's kind of work. It's like Stevie and I do these shows. We do these, we sit down, okay, people are working for a living, okay? They're busting their asses, hauling garbage or working in an office from 9 to 5, The heart is Steve and I, we go, our job is we sit at seats. These people come and tell you how great you are, and they throw money at you. And, you have to print pictures up. That's how hard it is. So it's a job in that sense, but it's easy. It's fun. Writing jokes is a joy, and then you have it. It's like a painter painting a picture, and you go, "This is what he'll paint for several days." And he goes, "This is my picture." So it was kind of working for those days, but you get this product, and it was worth it. He goes, "This is something I created," and he's proud of it. That's what an artist does.
I mean, you also write articles for several websites. I mean, what is it about
Right,
that you
that was
haven't?
back in the day. I haven't done that in
Or
a
do you
while,
not
but
do that
I did
now?
that. No, this was around 2010 to 2016. I wrote for Needorama and Mental Floss, all these, tons of Beatle articles I wrote. You'll see one tomorrow I wrote about when John Lennon said we're more popular than Jesus. You'll see that article tomorrow. But I wrote about all the Beatles stuff. I mean, the Beatles stuff's easy because I know everything about the Beatles.
Yeah.
But I write articles about different people, different events, that happened, and I did enjoy writing. It was fun for me.
Yeah, I mean, I did notice that it usually encompasses, there's several subjects which you're very passionate about. I mean, you have the Beatles, as you said, the Three Stooges. Do you consider those
Right.
guys your heroes?
Yes, absolutely. Curly Howard is my favorite comedian. He was the first comedian I loved when I was a kid. Three Stooges started my love for comedy. So they were tops. Curly's my favorite. Then I love Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. I love the Marx Brothers. I love Laurel and Hardy. I love Charlie Chaplin. I love Buster Keaton. These are my heroes,
Oh, fantastic. I mean, have you ever thought of compiling all these articles into a book, maybe, or?
That would be interesting. Maybe someday. You're right. I could do that maybe someday. I never thought of that.
Yeah, that leads me on to my next question. If you could have worked with anyone, during your career, and that could be living or dead, who would you choose? Who would be the ultimate person?
Let's see. In a comedy, I'm trying to think. For an actress, it would be Marilyn Monroe, for sure. For an actor, I would say maybe Dean Martin as a serious actor, or Frank Sinatra. Tom Hanks would have been my dream, because he's my favorite, but I got that fantasy, so that would have been great. Director, maybe Frank Capra, I love Frank Capra. I would love to have been in part of one of his movies. Jerry Lewis, I would love to have worked with. Curly, I don't know if I could have possibly worked with Curly, because he's so in that team, you know, but just to meet Curly would have been who I'd love to meet, you know, to shake his hand,
yeah.
Tell him how much he meant to me. He did, I mean, this guy did all this stuff, all these great movies he left. He left us like these 97 great shorts. He was done at 42. He had his stroke when he was 42. So he left this legacy of all these things. When he was 42, he was retired. But he was like the youngest guy ever, you know? So yeah. He did all this brain stuff. And I always go, he was the greatest comedian. He was as good physically as Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. If you look at him, he had the physical moves of them. Plus, he was a funny verbal comedian, which Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton weren't. So I consider him the greatest comedian of all time.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
you've been in many projects over the years, but which has been your absolute favorite? I mean, when you look back, what to you was the most enjoyable?
The two I always say are like the bookends. Grease was my first film, and I think I had the most fun doing that. And Polar Express, just because I had my favorite director, Bob Zemeckis, and my favorite actor, Tom Hanks. And another thing is I'm Jewish, but I always love Christmas. I'm a Christmas nut. And it was always on my bucket list. I wanted to do a Christmas movie. So I got to do that. So I got three things on my bucket list with Polar Express. So those were my two favorites, Grease and Polar Express.
Oh, fantastic. Well, as I say, it's become, you know, Polar Express has become a classic in its own right. I mean, millions of people love that thing. And as I say, we watch it every Christmas, but I know of a cinema where I used to live in the UK, and every year they have a showing of the Polar Express, and they invite people to come along in their PJs, and they serve hot chocolate.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's a I mean, yeah, we love it in this house. My mother absolutely adores it. We got her a little collector set at one point, which has the little bell. So whenever the bell rings on the screen,
cool.
She starts ringing the bell.
So, very cool. Well, give them my love. Give everybody my love and your family, please.
I will do. Thank you, Eddie. I'm sure they would say the same, you know, to reciprocate, because you've made so many happy memories in this house.
And well, thank you so much.
Anytime. And finally, if you had to choose just one cult movie of any genre, what would you choose? If you had to go to a desert island, maybe, and you just had to pick one film that's kind of like a cult movie, what would be your choice?
Well, I don't know if it's a cult movie. My favorite movie is A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles' first film. That would be my desert island movie. That's always my favorite movie. I have like a top 10 list of favorite movies, but Hard Day's Night is my favorite film, definitely. It's always been. I saw it when I was a kid. I went to the theater, you know, I was like 6 years old, and girls screamed all through it. It's like you went in for 90 minutes, and all you could hear was girls screaming, you know? And
yeah.
Then I saw Help the next year was the same thing, 90 minutes all screaming. This is in a little town, Cumberland, Maryland, you know, but the girls went crazy. But Hard Day's Night is my favorite movie. I love the music. I love the jokes. I love the Beatles. So that's my favorite movie.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'll make sure that's in there. So yeah, Mr. Deason, thank you for that. It's not only been a pleasure, but it's been a real honor. So really, thank you for taking time out of your schedule.
Thank you, DK. It's been my pleasure, and I just want to say you're a great guy, and thank you for being my Facebook friend, and I'll see you on Facebook. I hope you like my post. Make sure you give my posts all likes, too. That's how you can pay me back.
Definitely. I always try to, anyway, whenever I'm on and I see that you've been posting, I always go through, read them, and like them. So,
thank you.
Yeah, and to you out there, if you enjoyed this episode, please check out our regular episodes, always the first Tuesday of every month here on the Silver Screen channel, where we take a look at a cult classic. That includes 1941, which we talked about earlier. Hint, we liked it. So please do give that one a listen. Until we see you next time, please take care, and I'll leave our final words to Mr. Deason here.
Well, thank you. I want to say hi to everybody. DK is a great guy. Listen to his show. It is a great show. And listen to his podcast. They're very entertaining. And DK, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Anytime. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to the Cult Classic Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, with special guest Eddie Deason. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network. Copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.